Our guest this afternoon on the podcast is Phil Elliott. Phil, also known as Philip Elliott, but he's always been Phil to me, was a Courier and Press intern, then a Courier and Press reporter way back at the beginning of the century, and has moved on to much bigger and much better things now. Went to the Associated Press initially, and now is a reporter for Time Magazine. And Phil, I'll start off by asking you the question that I'm asking everybody, whether or not we're on a podcast right now, is how you feeling?
I'm feeling okay physically. Mentally, getting a little stir-crazy here during this corona crisis, but finding ways to cope, getting caught up on some reading lists, and discovering great podcasts like this one.
Are you adhering to the stay-at-home policy pretty well?
As much as I can. I mean, I have gone out for groceries and essentials, went to the CVS, picked up a prescription, but largely trying to shelter in place and take the stairs instead of elevators, things like that.
How does DC feel right now? Is it an eerie kind of feeling, or is there any semblance of the normalcy whatsoever?
DC was reluctant at first to start taking this thing seriously. I remember the weekend heading into St. Patrick's Day, running some errands and just seeing bars absolutely packed to the gills, people refusing to have their lives changed in any way by this. It wasn't until the mayor stepped in and really started shutting things down that it got real. But I went for a walk over the weekend, and the National Mall which this time of year is usually crowded with tour buses and runners, was absolutely dead silent. A friend of mine just posted on Instagram. He visited the Lincoln Memorial this afternoon for lunch and was the only person on its steps. It's just really, really creepy and almost post-apocalyptic here. I went for a walk yesterday just to get out of the house, and North Capitol Street, which runs directly into the Capitol, was absolutely silent. No one walking on the streets, and it was very creepy to see the NPR building there look almost deserted. It was really jarring.
How has this affected your work? You were covering some politics for Time, and then you were covering some congressional work. It's all kind of been a mishmash, but how has this affected you professionally?
Luckily, well, everyone in DC is always on their iPhones. So whether they were picking up my calls or taking my texts or responding to emails, that hasn't really slowed much. What has changed is our ability to have face-to-face interactions with policymakers and lawmakers. The best part about covering or going to work at the Capitol is that lawmakers are free to be approached. They don't keep us in pens. They don't make us stay in one certain section. Anywhere a lawmaker goes, basically, at the Capitol, you can go. You can ride the subway with lawmakers. You can walk up to them after lunches. You can grab them in the hallways as they go to vote. That's not happening now. After we passed the $2 trillion economic relief package, we made the announcement the Congressional Gallery was going to close, and we're going to severely restrict access to the Capitol. The public cannot go to the U.S. Capitol right now. So that's been one change. Another change has just been everything, excuse me, allergies, I swear. The shift has largely shifted from what we choose to care about. I mean, I began the year covering the impeachment trial in the Senate of President Trump. And then I wound up going to Iowa to cover the caucuses for that week, and New Hampshire from there, and then South Carolina. Now the campaign seems largely on hold, because the public is not interested in coverage of a campaign as though it were sport. There is a real crisis happening here in this country, and we've not yet seen the worst of it. I was looking at my phone this morning and seeing the headlines that more people have now died of coronavirus than died in 9/11, and we're not at the peak of it yet. So the campaign being on hold is largely just a reflection of what people are willing or interested in, and what news they're willing to consume at this point.
Let me circle back with you real quick. You were talking about not being able to have face-to-face interaction with a source. Can you talk for people who perhaps, you know, they don't do what you and I do for a living? Why is that important generally, and why is it not as ideal when you have to do things by text and by phone?
Well, I mean, you just get a lot. The whole basis of recording is trust in each other, that the source trusts you to accurately convey what message they are trying to send, what their truth is, what their situation is. And then there's just nonverbal cues you pick up from people. That it's one thing to have Lindsey Graham, for instance, say, sure, by text message, and it's another for him to roll his eyes dramatically, throw his hands in the air, and be just completely exasperated and say the same word, but you pick up such a different conveyance of meaning with that. It's also, there are things that people will tell you face-to-face that they'll just never put in print, either for security reasons, paranoia, or you just let your guard drop. It's the difference between having a conversation with grandma over the holidays and getting a birthday note from her. There's just a level of transparency and candor that you get face to face that you just don't get even by phone, let alone text and email. Those are even less revealing. And then there's also just, there are things that people will, members of Congress or politicians or staffers will tell you while you're waiting for, during long votes, or you're waiting for the lunch to end, that you're just chewing the fat. And they'll tell you things that they would never think to tell you, and they probably shouldn't be telling you at all, but they would never think to tell you by email. But if you're standing there and it's a hot piece of gossip, that you pick up on stuff like that. And then you have that in the back of your mind the next time someone mentions even something tangentially related. You're like, wait a minute, didn't I also hear this? And you can start piecing together better questions that way.
A big part of your summer is probably going to be wrapping your arms around a $2 trillion stimulus package that is making its way into the American economy right now. Is that correct?
That is. There's a lot in this for a lot of people, and it's a massive piece of legislation. It's bigger than the Wall Street Recovery Act, the Wall Street bailout. It's bigger than the Obama-era stimulus package. I mean, I remember sitting at the White House in 2009 and listening to some people suggest that we should, that stimulus package, which was ultimately about $880 billion, should be north of a trillion. And everyone, it was political here, was like, absolutely not. You cannot spend $1 trillion on an economic stimulus plan. It's too big. The American people will not go for it. And this one, we're sitting at $2.2 trillion.
And there hasn't been that public backlash either, really, has there?
There hasn't. And this is $2.2 trillion is on top of two previous bailouts. And now, even today, there's talk of phase four, if not phase five, to continue ramping up spending. To put this in perspective, the $2 trillion is more than America spends on Social Security. So this is just a massive chunk of the GDP.
How do you as a reporter get your arms around something that big? I mean, having fun saying don't write a story that's about world peace because it's impossible. How do you write about $2 trillion worth of stimulus?
You start breaking it apart into its components and then figure out, how did that component get in there? How did it come together? Why is it important? Who is benefiting here? And what are the political upsides of it? I mean, luckily, this thing is written in pretty plain English. There are some bills where it's the line is strike subsection D of part F of code, and you have no idea what. So you have to spend all of your day going and looking for the original things that they're amending. This was largely straightforward. There were some technical changes to previous laws, but they were pretty transparent and easy to read. They could have made this incredibly user unfriendly, and they did not. I think that was in large part because they needed to get it done, and they didn't have time to go and find where to jam this into other existing programs. They're like, no, we're just going to do it straightforward. For instance, the one piece that I'm really interested in is there's a $349 billion program for small business loans. And that is, and it basically it's the government paying small businesses to keep their lights open, keep their doors open, keep their lights on, I guess. Keep everyone on payroll, and if you make it through to the other side, all of those loans end up forgiven. So it's basically $349 billion in free money for small businesses. But you take a look at how this is administered, that it's not done through the Small Business Administration, it's done through commercial lenders. So you could go to your neighborhood credit union and get this. But the government pays the principal, but the borrower pays the interest. So now you start realizing why senators like Tom Carper, a Delaware Democrat, was on board with this, that the banks, which are mostly all registered in Delaware, stand to be making some interest on this. And interest on interest on $350 billion is going to be really good for their ledger. Right. So you start seeing, why was Tom Carper on the floor negotiating this with the small business chairman, Marco Rubio? Here we go. And then you start figuring out every piece of this legislation, well, now every piece of this law has a component to it where there has been, everyone gets something in this. I mean, you take a look, I mean, Congressional Police Department got $12 million for in the stimulus for staff salaries. You got like $25 million in there for congressional help to get them modernized, to buy them laptops. Like a lot of these staffers don't have laptops that they can work from home from. I mean, there are just so many components of this that you just start breaking it apart and saying, okay, this is an interesting idea. Let's see how this is implemented.
And so what do you hear about what 4 and 5 are going to be in terms of the phases? What can people expect next?
Well, the big lift that we're hearing is the SALT tax, the state and local tax deduction, which were eliminated in President Trump's last big tax cut. Previously, you were able to write off your whatever property you were paying to Vandenberg County or the city of Evansville for property taxes or income taxes, you could knock those off of your federal taxes.
And that's the one that really hammered people in the Northeast, wasn't it?
That killed New Yorkers. Yep. So much of your tax deduction was wrapped up in the high property costs. There, and that was taken away. That's why some members of the President Trump's Republican Party, such as there were a lot of them, especially the New York delegation, voted against it. There's talk about bringing that back, which would be a very nice carrot to bring along the mostly blue Northeast on another package here. There are just a lot of moving parts here. There's a lot of big ideas, but there's a lot of brake pad being used right now, especially among House Republicans saying, look, we're just now, we don't even have the checks out the door from phase 3. Let's see what phase 3 does before we start on phase 4. It is an election year. There is talk about another cash payment to Americans. Question of whether what we need to see what happened with the first round. I remember I was at the Courier the summer of President Bush's tax check. I remember writing stories from the business desk about people going out and buying DVR players. But I mean, it wasn't, basically it was a subsidy for Sony at that time.
And I think we'll, it was like $300 or something, wasn't it? Do I remember that correctly?
Yeah. It was like $300, and it was considered just a boondock. Like, what are you doing? You're all of this is borrowed money, and this was pre 9/11. So the economy was sliding, but not skidding. It's going to be interesting. What $1,200 is nothing to sneeze at, and that's per adult, and then you throw another $500 per kid, and that we're talking some serious money here. But it's also a question of whether that's going to the economy or going to your American Express card. Is this money that's already been spent, and you're just going to pay down your credit card?
Right.
Because we're heading into an economic scary time. We're not sure what's going to happen next. And if you've got this money in your pocket, are you really going to go out and splurge on something, or are you going to keep that as either a safety net or pay down stuff that you've already, or pay down the trip from last spring break that you still haven't paid off?
The House said they're in recess. I think it said till about April 20th. Was that about right? Do you see government in terms of Congress restarting in person by then, or is this going to be pushed back, you think?
My reporting tells me that they're going to reopen because they have to, but it might not be full staffing. That the stimulus package, the recovery package, however we want to brand it, the $2 trillion passed without a recorded vote. We don't have. Not everyone was there. They did it by a voice vote. There is talk, and there is reluctance to have this talk, but there is talk about setting up a remote voting situation or a proxy voting situation, that members could stay in their district and cast ballots from there. That has a real limited appetite, regardless of political party here, mainly because Congress is at its best, the most effective, when members are working with each other face-to-face, trading horses in the hallway, forced to come together, share a lunch. Every week, each party has, we call them the lunches, but they get together in a big room and they hear from leadership. If you're the Republicans, you hear from the White House. You trade ideas, you have big ideas come through, you get an update on messaging and calendar. And really, it's a cafeteria where, you know, cliques sit together, but you can tell something's up when you hear that, okay, Ted Cruz went over and talked to McConnell. Like, these people who are just like, okay, these people don't have a lot in common. What is going on there? And you always, and the lawmakers, there's only one door in and out of that room. But we all congregate. It's right off the Senate floor. And we congregate there and we pigeonhole lawmakers on the way to the elevators. And if you're lucky, the senator tells you to hop in the elevator with him or her, and you get to walk him back to the office and get the full readout. We're not getting that. And you can't get that remotely. There's only so much that can be accomplished on conference calls. And they haven't gone to Zooms yet, but I think we'll get there. We might get there. And then just institutionally, Leader McConnell, who controls the Senate, is a student of Senate history. And this would just not really jive with his sense of decorum on how the Senate is to be run. It's a remarkable to see just how well Leader McConnell knows the history of the Senate and its rules. Ultimately, it would require rules change. Congress can change its own rules to a large extent. I'm just not sure there's the appetite for it at this point. If they can get by with having, say, Tim Kaine come up from Virginia or Steny Hoyer down from Maryland and have bare-bones operations happening at the Capitol, the preference would be to at least keep Congress going in some form, if only because it's easier to get back to Washington than to start Washington up from scratch.
Let's talk just about you for a couple of minutes before we go.
Yeah.
You really sound like you've found your life's calling in political reporting. Is that the case? Is this what you've always kind of felt like you wanted to do?
Well, I just keep waiting for a job to open up at Food and Wine Magazine.
That'll be the second part of my question, but let's stick on this first. I mean, you sound like you really enjoy this.
I do. It's a privilege to be able to write for such an audience about such a variety of topics. I mean, my beat I'm the Washington correspondent for Time, one of a handful of us here in the DC Bureau. And really, anything that interests me, I can pitch about personalities in government, like quirky aspects of how we choose our leaders. I did a story last summer that the fight over gerrymandering was going to be decided starting last year with how state House and Senate districts were drawn, that you can basically reverse engineer gerrymandering to your state legislative seat, and which is why there's so much money being shipped into state led races last year and this year. That it's if you want to draw the battlefield, you start upstream. So there's that. I mean, I enjoy being able to take a complex, ridiculously arcane system, which is our Congress, our elections, our electoral college, media strategy, and figure out how to explain that to people who have a limited amount of time, but are intellectually curious and want to understand what's happening around them better. And that context, I think, is really important. And every day I get to wake up and answer my own questions about why is this thing this way? And I get to learn something new every day. And it feeds my curiosity. I won't say it satisfies it, but every answer I get, I have five other questions. Right. So for me, it's a constant series of asking questions and figuring out what questions haven't been asked yet, or at least haven't been asked by me. So someone somewhere knows this. Who is that person? How do I find them? And how do they make me smarter? There is nothing wrong with going to a source and saying, explain this to me like I'm a fourth grader. Because on this aspect, I know nothing more than a fourth grader, but I need to understand it. And if the source is really into it as much as, if you found the right source, that source is really there for that conversation and wants to geek out with you as much as you want to learn.
I asked Eric Bradner this too, so you get the same question. If you could write a book about anybody in DC, anybody involved in politics or government, who would it be right now?
Goodness, I would normally, I'm going to take this opportunity to plug my colleague's upcoming book by Molly Ball's book on Nancy Pelosi. I find her endlessly fascinating, but I'm not going to try to replicate what Molly has done with her book. I think right now, I would say Chef Jose Andres. He's on the cover of this week's magazine, but he has really stepped up in a way that our government leaders have not to confront human need right now. With the coronavirus, he previously had done a ton of great work after Hurricane hit Puerto Rico. He's just found this sweet spot between policy and politics and just humanity, where he has shut his restaurants down here in D.C. and has stepped in and turned these Michelin-starred gems into basically soup kitchens for restaurant workers. That he's going to take care of the hospitality industry here in D.C. that has been hit hard. All of our restaurants are under mandatory closures. And he's able to push policymakers to consider the human elements of this in a way that I haven't found many people have been able to effectively harness a bully pulpit as well as he has. I think it's an interesting way that sometimes the leaders we most need in the political realm are those who just step in from the outside. And this isn't unique to this situation. I mean, I remember there are plenty of examples of this, of people being drafted into this public arena from other industries, other realms, just because the moment called for them to do it and their personality matched with what we as a people needed. That's an unsatisfying answer and will probably be irrelevant a month from now. But I just at this moment, I'm just watching with admiration, Chef Jose Andres.
All right, let me ask you this. One last thing. You're a food wonk. You've always been as long as I've known you. If I ever come to D.C. and I say, Phil, send me to one place to have one dish, where are you going to send me and what am I going to eat?
Oh, goodness. That is I'm going to send you to Stoney's Restaurant on P Street. It's in Logan Circle neighborhood. I'm going to send you there to get the grilled cheese.
Really?
With onion rings. Yeah. I mean, there's a bunch of really terrific fine dining here, but at its core, this might be the best grilled cheese sandwich in the country. And it's not a fancy bar. It's a dive bar. They have, it's a neighborhood tradition. It's been around for decades. But they just do it so well. And I'm sure there's more dairy than bread in this thing in the forms of butter just smeared on it. But it has such a great crust. When I'm having a bad day, that is what I go to. I go in there, sit by myself at one of the high tops at the bar, and it's just perfection.
Is that a callback to your Rust Belt upbringing, the comfort food angle of it?
Oh yeah, I mean, I grew up outside of Youngstown, Ohio, and it is the perfect piece of comfort food. Their tomato soup is pretty good too, but I'd rather use the calories on the onion rings because they're just so crispy and basically it's bread. The onion is optional. The breading is what makes it. It's just great little salt bomb.
Well, Phil, thanks for the time today. I know even though we're all working from home right now, I know you stay busy enough that getting me a half an hour was fantastic, and I appreciate that.
Of course, Ryan. Great to reconnect.
All right. Take care of yourself.
You too.